Welcome to another edition of Progressive News Weekly. I am the black gold of the sun, and hopefully you are too. My name is Daryl Clark, and you are at the right place at the right time. Here at Progressive News Weekly, we bring you news and information called from around the world, and I'm so pleased to be able to do that again this evening, where we have a very, very special program for you this evening. As that bumper tune alluded to, I am the black gold of the sun. Well, we're going to speak to that to a significant degree this evening, because there's some black gold of the sun that doesn't even know the gold that's within. And I'm talking about our African-American children and the fact that too often they don't know who they are. So we're going to get into some of that later on in the program, and in fact, very, very shortly, with a very, very special guest of Progressive News Weekly. So I'm just going to hold that carrot out there. And for those of you who are on our mailing list across the country and beyond the borders of the U.S., we do have a few listeners in that category. Well, you know who that special guest is. Now, if you'd like to be privy to such information going forward, you'll want to send me an email to Daryl, D-A-R-R-Y-L, underscore, C-L-A, 1-8, at msn.com, and I'd be more than happy to add you to our mailing list. In fact, you can use that email address to comment on our programs, make suggestions, and please do let us know of topics and or guests that we might want to consider for the airwaves in the future. Many, if not most, of our programming comes from you, the listener. So before we get into our topic of the evening, which is African-American history, actually African and African-American history, and why it's crucial in our schools, especially our inner city and urban black school districts. But I wanted to touch upon a couple of things on that. One, I was perusing the internet as I do during the course of the week, and there was something profound that came out, and that is they found the oldest remains, human remains, ever found in the history of this planet. That's right, this past week. And can you guess where they found them at? Correct. Africa, specifically Ethiopia. So let's not make any mistake about it. We've been here. When I say we, I'm speaking about African Americans. I'm a proud African American. So that's sort of a backdrop that I wanted to speak to this evening. Speaking of African Americans, our president had an interesting week this week with a Congress that, well, the leader of the majority leader basically totally disrespected our president by inviting a dignitary from another country. I won't even dignify it by getting into the individual. We've got to do better in terms of speaking out on atrocities such as that. All I can say is totally disrespectful. I think you all know who I'm referring to. Was it Netanyahu is the name? And I'm not trying to be anti-Semitic, but for any dignitary to come and speak before our Congress without the consent of our president, we need to be very, very careful. And I find that interesting. In the wake of our president, Barack Obama, being accused of not being patriotic by his Republican politicians. So I just wanted to make mention of that. That's never happened before. I don't think it's a coincidence that our president is a black standing president. And I also don't want this to be misunderstood, that I completely concur with everything that our president has done. I believe, and I've had this debate right on this program more than one time, I just would like to see our president support the African-American community more than he has. I think he should step out, especially now when it's his last term and he doesn't have to play politics as much as he might have, even though I don't believe that he needed to play politics as much as he did in the first term. So I do have some issues there, but I've supported him from day one, and I have no regrets from that. What a wonderful thing to turn on the television and see an African-American president. But Obama, I'm still going to be a true brother, and I'm truly going to hold you accountable as I would any brother. And, of course, I'm going to support you as any brother would as well. So just a couple of little comments. If you have comments that you'd like to share in the next few moments, this actually would be a good time. You'll want to dial 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142. That not only applies now, but it also applies when we bring on our esteemed guest for the evening. As you know, we keep it live, and we encourage your input, comments, and questions. And so, again, the number is 347-838-9142 if you'd like to participate in this dialogue. And those of you who are listening in the archives, and I thank you, because our archives, week in and week out, are just jam-packed. I was looking at the statistics even earlier today, and I thank you for tuning in, because many just cannot catch the show live. But if you should have a question of any of our guests to my archive listeners, drop me an email, and I'll certainly reach back and get the answer for you. So keep that in mind for the programs ahead. Now, everyone should be buckled in by now and ready to go. Shout out to all of our listeners, regular listeners from California to Texas to Ohio, my hometown, Cleveland. Shout out to all of you. My folks in and around New Jersey, Essex County, Newark, Union County, Middlesex County, Somerset County. Shout out to everybody. We got a big blast of snow out here, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners out in from Tennessee and Ohio Valley and Pennsylvania got a little swipe of that. We have listeners in Georgia and Florida, Alabama. Can't forget Connecticut and New York. Of course, Massachusetts listeners, like to thank you for tuning in as well. Don't worry, spring is on the way. If I forgot anyone, you know I love you the same. So here we go. Our guest this evening, and as I said, he is truly a friend of Progressive News Weekly. He's been with us many times. And I actually, with that said, had been in a forum with this individual last month, and I was really impressed with the forum. And the topic of the forum was, why is African American history and African history so crucial and important for our schools, especially the schools in black districts and urban districts? And he and Mr. Donald Payne, former state senator, one of the first black senators in New Jersey, did an excellent job. And so I just thought that it's a topic worth reviewing. That, by the way, was hosted by an organization that I participate with, the Frontiers International. And Frontiers International is a national civic and community-minded organization geared towards the upliftment, education of the black community and society as a whole. And we will be doing a series every month, some series. Last month it was why education is important in terms of African American history. In fact, this upcoming week, Saturday, March 7th, for those of you in the Plainfield area at the Washington Community School, between 1 and 4 p.m., we will have as our guest Christine Dixon. And Christine Dixon is a performer, and she has performed as Harriet Tubman more than 188 times, almost 200 times, over 170 standing ovations. And so she's going to do a one-woman performance as Harriet Tubman at the Washington Community School. That's 427 Darrow Avenue, D-A-R-R-O-W Avenue in Plainfield. And you, for more information, can call 908-868-8704. And that's a little community announcement right here in the Plainfield area. If you have a community announcement wherever you are, please drop me a line, and I'd be more than happy to make an announcement, regardless of where you are, about things going on in your area. So with that said, I want to introduce our special guest. Kiel Kofani is a professor, actor, author, sociologist. He's also the director of the Africana Institute in Essex County College in Newark, New Jersey. He's recognized nationally for his body of work. In fact, his first book, The Hidden Debate, The Truth Revealed About the Battle Over Affirmative Action in South Africa and the United States, was nominated for two national awards, the Oliver Cromwell Cox Award and the American Sociological Association's Distinguished Book Award. This is a man that truly talks the walk and walks the talk. So I am so pleased to bring back to our airwaves our friend and special guest, Dr. Kiel Kofani. Welcome back, Dr. Kofani.
Hey, welcome, welcome. Thank you for welcoming me, and I'm just glad to be in your space. You know, I'm just a humble servant of the masses, and I'm here to do the work, to continue the work of those who came before us.
Well, you're certainly, as I said, not just talking that. You're walking that, and I'm following the work that you're doing. You know, as you know, we here at Progressive News always have your back with whatever it is that you're involved with, because it's always a good work. And so I look forward to continuing to collaborate with you in all of your efforts. And before it's all said and done, I'd love for you to post us on some of the things that you have coming up as well. I want to thank you for, you know, taking some time out to speak on this topic of African-American history. And, of course, naturally, I know it's near and dear to you as a director of the Africana Institute. When I thought about doing this, not only because I sat in the forum of which you keynoted, but even from years past, knowing your body of work, I knew immediately that I wanted to have you to participate in this. And by the way, listeners and Dr. Kofani, I don't think that this is something we just want to have a one-shot deal. Listeners, quickly on my soapbox, conservative radio, and I don't like that left-wing, right-wing kind of language, conservative, progressive, liberal, and all of that. When I say conservative, I'm talking that right-wing Tea Party ideology. They pretty much dominate, believe it or not, they dominate 70% of the airwaves. 70% of media is conservative. So that's why when you hear a Dr. Joy DeGruy or Dr. Craig Wright or Dick Gregory or Dr. Eddie Taylor and even my friend here, Dr. Akhil Kofani, say, it's so good to hear that I'm still doing this. And this isn't just Daryl trying to put himself up. I support all progressive radio. It's so important. It's a means of us talking to one another, keeping each other abreast of what's happening in our communities and for our best interest. And I'm just saying that because it was a few weeks ago we did have Dr. Eddie Taylor on, and he has a new book out, The Day the Crabs Got Out, talking about the fact that we just don't do enough to support our own causes, African Americans. And, of course, others, non-African Americans, they see that. And not being a non-African American, I can just only imagine what they're thinking with all the talent that we bring and have brought. And I could see why in some cases they might think, albeit wrong, they might think, well, it's their own fault, the problems that they're in. No, that's wrong, because then you start getting into that non-consideration of what we've been through that psychologically affects us. But they want to talk about solutions. And so with that, I just want to bring Dr. Akhil Kofani's perspective in. I love the way he approached this. Dr. Kofani, the way you approached that in that forum that I was in, my notes, I'm etching them in a typed format, which is so well done. So with that said, just if you would, at a high level, and we can peel back, as they say, the onion a little bit as we go forward in the interview, because you've got the program. It's Dr. Akhil Kofani night. If you could start at a high level, why? Why is it so important that we put some emphasis on this, even have this conversation?
Right. And once again, I thank you, and I'd be glad to do that. Let me just start off by offering one correction. You had mentioned that I was on the panel with Donald Payne, but it was actually Bill Payne, his brother. Payne.
Oh gosh, I say Donald.
Congressman passed. So
it sure was.
Yes. So
thank you for that correction.
I've done a bunch of work with
and beat up on that one.
Yeah. No. That's why we're here working together, right? So we support each other in wherever. We all have things that we, busy lives and things happen and we forget or something, and then, so we just correct it. That's all. You correct me, I correct you. We work together collectively on it.
All right.
So let me just start off by saying that with regard to the education piece is that, that same dialogue we had, I had another version of it last weekend with the Harlem Great Debates that was at Clark House, John Henry Clark House in Harlem. And it was two brothers debating it, and then I kind of did, me and Dr. Jeffries did the summation of it. And as we think about this particular debate was titled "The Three R's versus Africana Studies" or versus looking at starting things from an African-centered foundation. And of course, there's no debate there. And that was where we ended the whole discussion. The point is that we as African people, from the time of slavery, the objective was to steal the idea of being, right? And so that our ability to just be and to love and accelerate and to celebrate who we are, what we are, from which we came, and where we're headed. Those things were systematically destroyed in an effort to propagate a particular type of ideology, in order to propagate and to maintain a certain type of agenda. And if we look at it from its beginning, that was an enslaving agenda. Now, when we talk about an enslaving agenda, we often misunderstand it, because I think that we're so focused on the things that people tell us to look at that we don't look at it in ways that we need to look at ourselves. That is, that we don't have a deep level analysis that we need to have. And so with that being said, what I would suggest is that the type of analysis that we need is that these people who were enslaved weren't slaves, first and foremost, right? So the Africans were enslaved. They weren't slaves, wasn't their title. They were mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles, and they came from being artisans, from being skilled technicians, from being warriors, from being princesses and queens and chiefs. All these different things were in their purview and never left them. And so, but the idea was to eradicate those things. So enslaving wasn't just enslaving the individual, but the culture, the history. It was a cultural genocide which was engaged in. And so then to really get back to the foundations of just being, we have to reestablish our cultural foundations. We have to reconnect with them on a high level. And our ancestors tell us that, you know, it's not just about, we think about learning stuff and trying to figure out stuff, and we don't, so, you know, kids say they don't understand math. No, it's not that you don't understand, that the idea of synaptic nerves connecting, you know, you get that aha moment. It's really about that you're able to live this life of one remembering, right? Because that's what they really tell us, is that this life is one of remembering, so that when you get that so-called aha moment, or you get that epiphany, that what you end up with is that you're getting a way of seeing, doing, thinking, and being that was already within you, right? You mentioned that the oldest person was just found. Well, the DNA, the history, the spiritual foundations of all that knowledge from then to now is within all of us, and it's just about remembering that and reconnecting with that and then being able to utilize it in this lifetime, right? So that's really the foundations of where we are. And we've been working here in New Jersey for years now, and Bill Payne and his, I think, nephew were at the forefront of that, and that was working on the Amistad legislation. And the Amistad legislation was a bill that became law that said that African-American history is required to be taught in schools throughout the entire state of New Jersey, not just in the African-American community, but in all communities. And in that regard, that it became, when it became law, the challenge that we encountered was that there was no teeth to enforce it. It wasn't part of the testing system. And so if it's not part of the testing system, you can rest assured that the teachers, especially not in our districts, are not going to, for the most part, I won't say all because I know some that do, but for the most part, that they're not going to implement it on the level and way in which the Amistad legislation argues that it's supposed to be legally. But if you don't have money for it, you know, they have these what they call unfunded mandates. And then on top of the unfunded mandates, if you don't have anything that's legally forcing someone or requiring someone to do something where there's consequences, then if it's not something that they're already interested in, the probability is that they're not going to do it in the first place. And so then that's where we end up in this discussion, is that people are resistant to doing something that they that they're interested in, or they're not interested in doing, but their whole push behind it becomes one of doing that which is easy and which follows the line of the testing, right? So that's where we are now with the whole new park and all that other stuff. But I want to go back for a minute, because in the book that I wrote called The Hidden Debate, there's a whole discussion in there about the idea of being, right? And that what Africans really want to do and wanted to do, when you look back at the civil rights struggle, when you look back at all these different struggles that we fought for to gain freedom, to gain to participate in a just and fair society, one where we saw and felt and experienced equality, was that we wanted to restore something that we as Africans have had and understood from the beginning. And these are two concepts. One is Ma'at, and the other is Ubuntu, right? Ubuntu is the Southern African concept. There's different words that they use different places in the continent, but here in the States, we say that I am, therefore we are. So there's this symbiotic relationship between the individual and the collective, between the collective and the individual, and that we don't use the Descartesian analysis that I think, therefore I am, that is individual-based, right? And so then that becomes a dichotomy. And the other dichotomy is the idea of Ma'at. And Ma'at is this ancient Kemetic, which is also Egyptian, which is African. They want to take Egypt out of Africa, but the reality is that Egypt is in Africa, always has been. And that the idea of Ma'at is about truth, justice, righteousness, harmonious balance, and reciprocity. And that the interesting thing is that when they look at Ma'at, that the principles of Ma'at in the end say that if someone lived their life in such a way that they had a heavy heart, that throughout the course of their life they had a heavy heart, then the problem is that they didn't live that life properly, and that they have to circle back through the process. They didn't get the lessons, and that those lessons are valuable and important. So that when we think about that, these two fundamental precepts, Ma'at and Ubuntu, that Africans have always had this high sense of thinking about the way in which they relate to the world. And there's one other one. There's a proverb, and it goes like this. It says, "Moto ke moto kabato," and that means that that one's humanity is both stated and reaffirmed by how humanely you treat your neighbors, and that your neighbor's humanity is attested to by the same thing. So once again, this symbiotic relationship about humanity, and so that they encountered people who treated them inhumanely, so they didn't really see them as human, almost. That they saw these people, in this particular case, Europeans, who used techniques that turned out to be trickery. And, you can read about that part of it, and things fell apart. That book talks about, the experiences of Okonkwo. And Okonkwo is this strong African warrior and family leader, and when the missionaries and other folks come in, and ultimately the colonialists come in, and they've been tricked, and so they had tried to keep their distance, but the realities of it were suggesting that that they shouldn't, because they, a bunch of people in their community had been brought into the idea that the ways in which the missionaries were suggesting things was the way to go, and it was taboo to create or I'm sorry, it was taboo to commit suicide in their society, in as the story goes. And in the end, he commits suicide, but nobody wants to touch him because how can he do such a thing? But the underlying piece about the story was that his idea about being was so undermined that he no longer could figure out how to be, and that his cultural ideas and identity were both enslaved, and then from being enslaved, that genocide was committed, and that genocide manifests itself in his own self-annihilation. And that's unfortunately what we see here in the States, that we have lots of self-annihilation, maybe not to the extent of committing suicide, but that we don't cherish and celebrate our own African culture. We don't see the relationship between African spirituality and other forms of spirituality that we practice. We don't see the relationship between what the Africans, brothers and sisters, do on the continent and what we do. And, you know, the interesting piece about it is that even on the continent, I had a lot of conversations with brothers and sisters on the continent about this, is that oftentimes even they sometimes, you know, don't even utilize their own traditional cultural ideas and heritage because of the pressures and the imposition of colonialism, right? That colonialism and imperialism had the same impact as cultural hegemony, I mean, as cultural genocide and enslavement in the Americas. And so then when you look at the underlying experiences of Africans on the continent and Africans, that is on the African continent, and Africans or African descendants in the Americas, not just the United States, but in the Americas, you see that we have similar things. I just watched a whole thing on African Canadians, and there was a thing about this people teaching about the African Canadian history in classes and the exploitation that they experienced, the racism that they experienced, and that they had pictures on the walls of Martin Luther King, of Barack Obama, of Malcolm X, and Marcus Garvey. They see a closer relation between us than we see between us and them. We don't even know half the times that they exist. But there's a whole African community in Canada, and we need to figure out ways to connect with all these folks. I think that bridging the gap between Africans in the diaspora all the way from the top of Canada down to the bottom of South America, then we will begin to transform our reality, our experiences on another level. Because until then, we continue to be enslaved. We continue to be not able to be, right? That goes back to my fundamental principle about the idea about being, that we can't be because we've been stripped of a lot of the cultural foundations that are, and the historical foundations that show that we've made substantive contributions to this world. And the way we transform that is that we have to go back to those fundamental principles. And so that's why African-centered education in the schools is fundamental, right? That to me is the crux of the argument.
Wow. You mentioned something profound there when you talked about that link, when you just went into that colonialism that our African brothers and sisters went through. And they still are feeling the effects of that, similar to us still feeling the effects, chattel slavery. It's that, who was it? Dr. Joy DeGruy, post-traumatic slave syndrome. And there's been many, many other authors have talked about it as well, those effects. And we need to step back, I'm hearing you say, and say we need to take not just a American perspective of this, but really let's step back and take a global look at this. And that is profound. We do have listeners out of Canada as well, and many of the islands. And again, not to push this show, But for any progressive program that is trying to uplift our community, we need to be supporting, you know, one another and germinating that. You know, that might be one of the venues, I would dare say, I believe it is, to try to facilitate that in happening. And then something else that you mentioned was some of the challenges that, you know, some of the districts have, such as unfunded mandate and no testing requirement. But to that, let me ask you, to some extent, aren't those possible scapegoats or crutches that can be used, especially in African-American districts? I mean, can't we be creative?
Oh, well, I think that, you know, one of the things that from a bunch of folks who I know who are in the district or in a lot of the African districts in Orange and Trenton and Newark and East Orange, that, you know, some of them talk about having those things and wanting to do them. But I thought at one point that it was, a lot of it was just kind of, as you were saying, you know, kind of skate around the issue. But, you know, it's interesting the way the districts operate at this point. And I used to be the president for Adelaide L. Sanford Charter School, so in Newark. And, you know, that's another discussion we can get into maybe a little later. But when you look at the folks who are in district schools, that they get penalized sometimes for going off of the curriculum. They get penalized for not covering the information in the way in which it's supposed to be covered. Some districts have some flexibility, others don't. And now with this new PARC testing, teachers are being graded, if you will, or, you know, they're being assessed as to whether or not they perform well enough, looking at how the students do. But the problem is that PARC is not even being used this year. So you know, it's not being used as a standard for students. It's really a guinea pig system for kids, unfortunately. That you know, here our children are being subjected to testing that that's not being utilized as a measure of standards. But nonetheless, there's lots of money being spent, lots of computer programs and equipment that has to be bought, bandwidth that has to be increased. And then it's ancient technology that they're forcing the schools to use. So, for instance, kids nowadays, they're all using handhelds and things that have touch screens. But the PARC test, you have to use a mouse for. Some of these kids don't even know what a mouse is, except for using it on a PARC test. So it's absurd that would be a requirement for something that's a regressive technology. That's the type of stuff that you know that our communities and our teachers are confronted with. So I understand your point, but I think that there are some pressures from the district level and even from the principal level that are imposed upon teachers that is antithetical to something like the Amistad legislation. That doesn't mean that the principals couldn't become creative and do stuff, but until there's testing, and with so much other testing going on, it's really kind of challenging sometimes to navigate that space.
So what would be an approach? More involvement by parents? Should the principals then solicit that with town hall or school-wide meetings requesting parental input? Hey, look, my hands are tied, but maybe you can free them through your board of ed, maybe take this to the state level, maybe collaborate with other districts. I'm just trying to think outside the box because not in the 30s, and I would think that because we do have a certain amount of freedom of speech that and with technology that we'd be able to collaborate in their strength in numbers. I don't think this is something that's insurmountable. But I know people
right.
think time is crucial.
So with that being said, this is how I perceive it. And I think that you're right that those strategies are useful. But what I told Bill Payne a couple of years back is that, and you know, we need to have other folks in the legislature and in the Senate now who can address this. But my thing is that what was not included in the legislation, and he said that there was resistance to it when he tried to put it forward, but what's not in the legislation is that testing is not in the legislation. So my thing is that at this point, we need to go back to the legislature and have the legislature mandate that not only is this required, but that when they do these standardized tests, i.e. PARC or whatever other tests they use, that the requirement of understanding and knowing African and African-American history is an integral part of that. And so that then you can't escape it because it's in the test every single year and not just in the African districts, but throughout the entire state. And so then I think that the parents, I think that the school boards, we elect them, so then they should be doing the work, our work as a community, the city councils and town councils, the Senate and the assembly, all of whom should be pushed to make the very point about transforming it so that it is a required thing that's not just something on the books, but something that's actually done, and that because the challenge is. And I was at a program. I spoke at a program about a week or two ago for the I think it was called. I can't remember the name now, but it was for a organization that's trying to do work related to Africans on the continent who are recent migrants here and their relationship. But the person who was the Alan Timoleko. Who was the past president, made a powerful statement. And another friend of mine, Dosso Cosimo, makes this statement on a regular, but many times folks don't. And that is that he said that as a recent African migrant to the United States, I pay tribute and great homage to the Africans who sacrificed to even be here today. That is that those brothers and sisters from the islands and from the continent who are here today, who are able to come here today, who are able to travel on a plane and get here, are only able to do so because those of us who died, those of us who got beat, spit on, lynched, burned, and all the other atrocities, the terrorizing relationship that we had in this country, those terroristic and tormenting experiences are the fundamental underpinnings why all the other folks are able to come here. The civil rights struggle didn't happen just because they wanted to. The civil rights struggle happened because African people were fed up with the social conditions, and they, along with other folks, worked to bring about transformation. The same was true at the end of slavery. And so then those reasons, and this was the other thing he said, and he started to cry at this point, which I thought was serious, because he said that those Africans who came over, those who died on the ships, are our descendant ancestors, and so that we today are their descendant ancestors. And that was the first time I heard somebody from the continent use that type of terminology to talk about us at here, that to see us in that way, because it's like to say that they see us in an elevated way because of the type of sacrifice that we went through. And that's powerful.
Wow. You know, Dolso's been on the program several times also, and as I'm listening to you, I think it's been too long. We have to have him back because you're absolutely right. And that brings to mind something very interesting, tying back again to what you were saying about Canada and our brothers and sisters, you know, throughout the Caribbean and the islands and even, you know, in South America and other places around the globe, there is that link. And yet we're almost as though we're a people that act as though we don't have a link, such as
right.
Irish or the Italians, or, you know, we almost act as though we don't have that. And I think that goes back to that education piece. That seems like the mortar that's missing.
Right, no, because we've been miseducated for so long. I mean, Carter G. Woodson talked about this a long time ago. He talked about the miseducation of the Negro. But he also talked about the education of the Negro. And I think that when we do some new assessment, we have to begin to assess it in those ways. What have we been miseducated about? And what do we hope to transform our educational experiences into? So I tell my students all the time that you all are sheep. You go through life as sheep. And that you're in my class to be waking up, because we need to be awake and understand the social conditions for the world in which we live, and you know, I mean, my students are across the board: African, Latino, Asian, Iranian, Muslim, wherever, from Indonesia to the Philippines, and so. From Switzerland. I have students from all over the place, and so in these encounters, I tell them all. I show them things, and I try to get them to understand that we don't see things that are in front of our face the way we think they are. We take the obvious to be the reality, and that you know, we hope that in sociology they learn to question the obvious. And because there's so many things that are going on that they don't pay attention to. For instance, there's a video. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's called it's an awareness test, and it's called the Dancing Bear. And when you watch this video on YouTube, you see the guys passing basketball, but then there's a trick that goes on, and it asks you later, you know, well, this is how many times they passed the basketball, but did you see X, Y, and Z? And I encourage your listeners to check it out, The Dancing Bear, an awareness test, and see if they see what's going on. Because sometimes we're so programmed to look for something that we don't look for the obvious. And there's so many things that happen in our face that is the real thing, but we're watching for something that somebody told us to watch for that we miss the real thing that's in our face.
Wow, that's that miseducation.
Right.
Carter G. talks about, and it's so interesting. He talked about that so very long ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're still experiencing it today, to our own degradation. And so when I think in terms of that, it makes this topic so very, very critical and crucial. And as you know, you've been with Progressive News many years. We're not just about that conversation. We don't like to leave the airways without some deliverable. Just if you don't have children, you know, yourself, then reaching out to a child or someone that has a child, delivering a message. If it's just being in the grocery store line or the bank line or post office line or wherever it is that you're around other people or across the fence of your neighbor, you know, having some kind of a deliverable that can just pop maybe a little seed there that is bound to germinate. If that were the case and that's what we are about, what would that message be that you would send out that can help make a change, Kofani?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first thing is that we all have agency. Right, that we all have the ability to effectuate change. Sometimes we see ourselves as helpless, and you know, we go through life saying, "Well, that's just the way it is, and it's going to be that way." But what we really want to understand that it's not just that way. If it was just that way, Harriet Tubman wouldn't have saved anybody from being enslaved. If it was just that way, you wouldn't have had so many people who are. Who were engaged in the transformation of things like the Belgian Congo, right, where all these Africans were tortured and tormented for years and years and years. You wouldn't have a liberated South Africa where it wasn't just South Africa involved, but all those neighboring countries who are willing to help South Africa and Cuba that was willing to help South Africa. So, you know, these relationships mean that we have agency. We have the ability to effectuate change, and we have to challenge ourselves to do that. We have to be willing. Derek Bell talks about, he wrote a book called Ethical Ambitions. He's deceased now, but he wrote a powerful book called Ethical Ambitions. And in Ethical Ambitions, he talks about he raises a question. He says in the very beginning of the book, he has a quote before the book even begins. He says, how do we maintain our integrity while seeking success? And I was like, whoa, that is deep. And what he says by that is that first it's about how do we define success? And I think that's the underlying question about what you're saying is, how are we defining success? Well, first of all, we have to define success for ourselves. And once we've defined success for ourselves and not let somebody else define what success is, then we have our own parameters that we're working towards. And then he says that we have to be willing to take risk, that we have to be courageous, and that what we have to do is we have to have passion about the things that we're participating in and the things that we believe. And so that when we have passion, we have courage, we are willing to take risk, and we are selfless, then we move to another level. We move to another level of consciousness and another level of operation. And I think that's really where we want to go. And I think that's, to me, the greatest piece of advice is that we have to operate beyond ourselves. And Ptahotep, a great visor from ancient Kemet, one of the oldest books known to humankind, written about 2500 BC or maybe a little earlier. And he gives us this whole story about standing that we have to be selfless, that we have to have humility, and having humility enables us to treat each other humanely. It enables us to be powerful beyond our wildest dreams, because we know then that power is not about how we control others, but how we control ourselves, how we are able to interact with our environment in positive ways. That's the ultimate level of control. It's not about controlling things and people. It's about understanding that you have a responsibility to the world in which you live, the environment and the people, and that in having that relationship, that you, if you can control how you do that in a way that's uplifting to both the environment and to the people, then you have power. Then that's real power. But if we collectively came to that understanding, then I think that we would really be moving somewhere. And I think that therein lies the crux of the thing, is that our agency sometimes is skewed because we get sucked into a kind of a capitalistic idea, and then our agency is based on us doing things that lend us to seeing success as how much money we can earn, seeing success as how many cars can we have, how big a house can we have, how many flat screen TVs and cell phones can we have, as opposed to what have I done to transform the world that I live in? How many people have I uplifted? How many people who have I been able to help get food who don't have food? How many people who are struggling with the realities of the world, I've been able to, that is African people in particular in this case, have I been able to help them to understand who they are in a historical context that they've been able to reconnect with their Africanity? And if you look at the works Asa Hilliard, at Temple University was Malefe Asante. Malefe Asante wrote lots of books, and he came with this idea of Afrocentricity. Not everybody agrees with that idea, but I think the underlying principle there is that, I think that he's done a lot of great work. The underlying piece about Afrocentricity is that I would say even it should be an Afrocentricity, because there's no O in Africa, but the underlying point is that see and understand and appreciate our African history and experiences in everything that we do. That in our analysis, we have to have an African analysis as the foundation of our analysis of the world in which we live. And when we are able to do those things, that we begin to see ourselves reflected in stuff. It's not being against someone else. It's that you have to understand where you fit within the picture. If you only fit yourself in the picture through the eyes of somebody else, then you've negated yourself. You can't, once again, go back to my very first concept, you can't even be. And we need to be as African people. We need to understand our existence to the rest of the world, and then to celebrate that existence so that then we can participate in the world as equals, as opposed to those who see themselves as lesser than because we don't fully participate in ways. So Naeem Akbar, in a book that's similar to the works of like Joy DeGruy, but he talks about breaking the chains of psychological slavery. And so in that book, he says that, you know, we think that we're free, but there's chains on us, and they're still, like Malcolm said, that they're behind our eyes and we can't see them. And so that the way you break those chains is that you have to begin to see yourself and talk about and position yourself in the structure of everything that you do. So he talks about the dichotomy of folks, you know, and Malcolm talked about this, Joy DeGruy talks about this, that when we go to African churches and other facilities, that we don't have African representation, right? So that there's picture of Jesus, the picture of the saints. You know, I mean, I've been into churches where even St. Maurice is presented as a European. Now, St. Maurice was a Moor, so that means he was an African. So how can you not have St. Maurice as an African out of all the other saints? You know, and so then those types of things to me are fundamental ideological problems that are presented that we haven't began to assess in those ways. And there's a couple of videos out now that people are discussing. As a matter of fact, in East Orange, I did a discussion the other day on one of them, and that was not Living Color. What is the new video called? Something Colors 1, 2, and 3. Hidden Colors 1, 2, and 3. Have you seen those?
No, I'm not familiar.
Okay, yeah.
But
so
I like
this book. Yeah, there's these documentaries or discussions called Hidden Colors 1, Hidden Colors 2, and Hidden Colors 3, and so that they all approach things from these diverse perspectives, and they begin to talk about how we as Africans fit within the context of them. And I think, you know, it provides some very interesting discussion, and, you know, a lot of people, it resonated with a lot of folks. And, you know, it's not that I agree with everything, but I understand enough of it and I agree with enough of it to know that I think that they bring a valuable discourse to the table, and so that we need to begin to have those types of discourses so that we can see how we fit in the table, how we fit in the discussion, and then begin to rearticulate how we fit in, you know, because it's not just about fitting in a historical context, but it's in a contemporary context. How do we envision our African experience in a westernized society? How do we dictate our experience? And I'll give you a case example historically how to look at this. So when Africans were freed at the end of slavery in the United States, their understanding was that their vision, and Du Bois writes about this in, I believe, Souls of Black Folks, that they either that or Dust of Dawn, I can't remember which one of those two books, but he says that their experience was for freedom was not exactly as they expected it to be, and that Europeans' interpretation of freedom for them was different than the Africans thought it should be. So, for instance, Africans thought that freedom meant that they also were going to be living and participating in a just and equal society. So freedom for them meant having justice and equality. It didn't just mean that you were free to get off the plantation and not be beat and be able to go where you want to. It meant that all of the things about justice, all the things about equality that Europeans experienced, they thought that they were going to experience. But the reality of it is that the interpretation of freedom by Europeans for Africans was different, and their ideas of freedom for Africans didn't mean the same freedom that they experienced. And so then that's where the conflict arose, right? And so then that conflict brought up lots of tension. And because Africans had to continue the fight for freedom after that point, had to continue fighting for freedom as they saw it in their own eyes. So then you go from that particular experience after slavery to a place where there's a movie. One of my students in a documentary called "Slavery by Another Name." This whole thing on convict leasing. Have you seen that?
I'm familiar with that. Mm-hmm. That's powerful.
It is. So that PBS documentary was powerful. It talked about convict leasing and that the increase in the prison thing. And then you had this other sister who came out with a book recently, Michelle Alexander, and she talks about the whole thing with the new Jim Crow, and that she says that crime hasn't actually increased by number or percent, but that the thing that's really increased is the criminalization of certain behaviors and of certain people. And so, in other words, the sentencing on certain crimes that were already happening at a certain level changed, and that the number of people who became the folks imprisoned were increased. So Africans became something that there was an increase in prisons. The number of Africans in prisons began to increase exponentially. And then after slavery, of course, you know, when if you go back and read the Constitution, that slavery was illegal in all forms except in the case of those who were imprisoned. So if you were in prison, then you still could be treated like a slave, even to this very day. And so then you see that you know, now with the private prisons and all the other stuff, you have people who are working basically as slave laborers. You know, if you got you're doing a job that's wrapping holiday gifts and making hotel reservation calls and stuff, and you're doing all that stuff, and you get 10 cents, 25 cents, 35 cents an hour, and the prison company is getting $5, $10 an hour. So then that means that they're over several 100% greater a profit from your labor if you're imprisoned. And so then the number of people in prisons just continue to escalate, even though the crimes themselves haven't escalated.
Wow.
But we don't have those questions. We don't have those discussions enough to be able to think about that. We basically look at it and say, well, you know, somebody's in prison, then they must have did something wrong. Well, you know, maybe yes, maybe no, right? I mean, when you look especially at the end of slavery, when they were doing convict leasing, they had something called vagrancy laws. If you were sitting out just, you know, talking and hanging out with your friends, you could be arrested if you didn't show them you had some job or you something else. Well, wasn't that many jobs to be had. But, you know, you could have vagrancy laws. You could be arrested just on GP. And that was the type of stuff that our people continued to go through for many, many years. And even to this day, you know.
It seems like there's another form of that now where we're disproportionately placed in prisons today. And it's interesting. Wow, I'm looking at the clock. We have about 60 or so, 90 seconds. But I was just thinking about how we're disproportionately placed in prisons based on laws that disproportionately are not in our favor, based on our lifestyle.
Yeah.
And so what I like to do is pick this up sometime in the future, maybe later in the month, or because we don't do African American History Month here on Progressive News Weekly. Every month
That's right.
is African History Month, as you know. You've been on many times throughout the year. But I'd like to pick this up and maybe just right from the start of the program, just open the airwaves up maybe with you, and maybe we can, because you have referred to the legislation that was, you know, enacted right here in New Jersey by Bill Payne. And maybe we can pick up on some of this dialogue and focus more on what we can do to enact some of these changes that need to be done, because we need power, and as Naeem Akbar would say, power is not money. Power is the ability to affect change in your best interest. And so I'd like to publicly put you on the spot and invite you to come back when we can perhaps work with me to maybe put a little form together, and then we'll publicize it broadly, because this isn't just a New Jersey thing. This is a national thing. And see what kind of footing we can get to try and impact some change in our schools, especially urban and black.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. That sounds great.
Absolutely fantastic. For those of you who joined us late, you can catch it in the archives, but we have been talking with Dr. Akhil Kofani. Talk about change agent, Dr. Kofani. That's you. Change agent, author, sociologist, professor and director of Africana Institute at Estes County College. How can they reach you if they want to, if they're local and they want to think about trying to get in one of your courses or some of the work that you're doing?
Sure. They can reach me a couple of ways. One is that you can reach me via email at Kalfani, that's Khalfani, at essex.edu. They could also go to the college website, and that's www.essex, that's E-S-S-E-X, .edu/AI, and that'll take you to the Africana Institute's link, and you can see a bunch of work that we do there. And those are the best ways to get in touch with me.
Excellent, excellent. Dr. Akhil Kofani, as always, it has been a blast, and boy, you took us to new heights, and I certainly appreciate that. We'll be in touch. Let's make this thing happen so that we can affect the change that you were talking about. And truly, you know, to answer that question, as you said, we need to, in effect, get involved. We all can effectuate change, as you put it. Thank you again, Dr. Kofani.
You're welcome. Anytime.
All right. Well, we've come to the end of another program. We did not have the opportunity to open the lines up, but as you heard Dr. Kofani commit to, he will be back, and we're going to do a panel. We're going to make some change. This has got to happen. He listed numerous resources and books, and so if you go back to the archives, you can catch some of that, and I will reach out to Dr. Kofani as well and get the authors of them. So if you'd like to reach back to myself at Daryl, D-A-R-R-Y-L, _CLA18 at MSN.com, I'll get that. Or you can go right to Dr. Kofani at www.essex.edu/AI. So with that said, we've come to the end of another program. Of course, you, the listener, first and foremost, because we wouldn't be here without you. I'd like to thank Cecil, my partner and colleague and friend, for the engineering work that he does week in and week out. And, of course, to all of you who are sending in those emails and suggestions and comments that just help us to do a better job. I encourage you to go to the archives at blogtalkradio.com/Renfort. And not only check out my archives, but there are numerous other programs on the Radio by Renfort Network that I'm sure you will take a delight in. So with that said, peace and blessings. And until the next time, everything's going to be everything.
Yo, we about to check.